Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about too much television time is bad for kids' blood pressure. Some new research that we should pay careful attention to. And this is in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine. Also, oxytocin. That's our love hormone. And we know how good it is. Duke University says it's more than just making you feel good about who you're with. It actually enhances spirituality. We'll take a look at that. Smoking leaves lasting marks on the DNA. This is the U.S. National Institutes of Environmental Health Science. Okay, you say, so what? You stopped smoking 20 years ago. Yes, and you'll still end up getting cancer in all probability. The part of the puzzle that is missing is what can we do with these defective DNA markers? I'll explain. A meta-analysis shows that there's benefits to magnesium in migraines from Taipei Medical University. And men with anxiety are more likely to die of cancer, Cambridge University. And also, I want to talk about laughter-based exercise for people have lots of benefits from Georgia State University. So we have a lot to talk about on health issues. Then a commentary from Chris Hedges, a brief one, and it'll be a part of our talkback segment today, The Courtiers and the Tyrants from Truthdig. Also today, a part of our discussion will be talkback, will be the U.S. officials stating Israel is spying on America at, quote, terrifying levels from Jeffrey Phillips from Business Insider. And this means that Israel spies in the United States more than any other ally, spies on us, and why this is not a good thing. And in England, they finally come to the conclusion that with a special investigation and a panel that David Cameron, the former prime minister, was, quote, ultimately responsible for Libya collapse and the rise of ISIS. This is a House of Commons report. It's a scathing verdict. And that was just after Cameron just suddenly announced that he was leaving Westminster immediately. And why, if they could find in Great Britain that the prime minister was guilty, why can't we find that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were guilty? Because it wouldn't happen without Hillary Clinton. She was the driving force behind it. And why have none of the major media gone to Libya throughout the country and looked at its infrastructure, which is completely destroyed, looked at the theft of its oil, and looked at the poverty of its citizens, and then said, wow, this didn't work out so well, did it? And yet the very same people who did this are now telling us that we should prepare for war against Russia or China, or we should go in and invade Syria and put no-fly zones in. They've been wrong about everything forever. In fact, they've never been right about anything, ever. They were wrong about Vietnam. They were wrong about Grenada. They were wrong about Panama. They were wrong about Afghanistan. They were wrong about Iraq. They're wrong about Libya, they're wrong about Syria, and they're wrong about Iran. So why does the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and MSNBC constantly support their op-eds or their supposed experts' opinion of what to do when they've never been right? We'll discuss that. Also, with the TPP being challenged, isn't it time that we looked at what we as citizens can do with people power versus corporate power? Also from our audio file today, from Congress, a very short clip, why we can import vegetables and fish from all over the world, but we cannot import inexpensive generic medication from Canada made in Canada by the same manufacturer, the same owner, as in the United States, which would save hundreds of billions of dollars. And it'll be interesting to what you hear the head of the FDA say on this, who is a pro-pharmaceutical physician. Also, did you ask yourself what happened to the billions, anywhere from $11 to $15 billion raised, or at least promised, during Haitian relief? Well, I found a clip from Vice TV that shows you. They just went down there and they looked. They spoke with people. And then I'm going to follow that up with a commentary from a person who is Haitian, who has specific ideas about what happened. And the title of the article, it's a short article, "I, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Haiti's Pay-to-Play New President," by Dabby Cherry. So we'll hear from Haitians about what really goes on in Haiti. And for those of you who don't believe there's a pay-to-play, there is. And this is one way that you understand it, both from the audio clip and separately from an article from Haitian activist. If time permits, lying politicians cannot explain $9 trillion missing from the Federal Reserve. This is an interesting grilling in a congressional hearing, and I believe that we need to hear this. Also, I heard someone talk about how they were comparing Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. That's just stupid, and that's highly reactionary. But that said, how Adolf Hitler rose to power in a democratic country is a lesson for us to learn today. So take away the Donald Trumps and the Hillary Clintons, and how did he get that power? And how are people accumulating power today? Is there an association? Is there a lesson to be learned? Time permitting, we'll play that clip. So you see, we have a lot to share. There was a major study, in fact, it reviewed multiple studies published in Pain Physician, that showed that magnesium is terrific for helping treat and prevent migraine headaches. Researchers at Taiwan University analyzed random trials on the effects of both intravenous magnesium on acute migraine attacks and oral, taking it by mouth. And they looked at almost 1,000 individuals, and they found that magnesium makes all the difference in the world. And there's no harmful side effects. And it's good for your heart. And it relaxes your muscles. Quote, "This is the first meta-analysis to evaluate the overall effects of intravenous and oral magnesium on acute migraine attacks and the prophylaxis of migraine, respectively. We confirm that intravenous magnesium has beneficial effects in relieving acute migraine attacks, and that oral magnesium supplements alleviate the frequency and intensity of migraine. Thus, we suggest that intravenous and oral magnesium should be considered as adjunctive therapies for managing acute migraine attacks and the prophylactics of migraines, respectively," end quote. Well, in lay language, they're just saying, take your magnesium and help prevent migraines. From Specialist Hospital in Poland comes a study published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition showing that you are more likely to relapse in the winter with multiple sclerosis if you're low on vitamin D, and therefore get your vitamin D levels up, and you're less likely to have a relapse. And I would absolutely agree with that. 3,000 to 5,000 units a day. From Cambridge University Institute of Public Health, men over 40 who have generalized anxiety, meaning they're functional, they go to work, there's just this sense of foreboding, there's a sense of uncertainty, there's this gnawing sensation in your gut that something's wrong and you can't change it. Now, rarely do men talk about these things. They think it shows that they're not masculine or they're going to not be considered responsible. But men should be able to be open and discuss these issues. I remember it was 10 years ago, I did a health support group for men. But it was unlike regular health support groups. The latest health support group, by the way, completes on Saturday. We will finish 3.5 months, and we'll have some magnificent data. I'm sure of that because I've got word, even though I was out of town, that when they were giving their oral presentations, some major things simply are no longer in their life: pain, arthritis, diabetes, high blood pressure, weight loss, sleep problems, gone in a high number of people. So anyhow, we'll have good results. How good, we'll know when the independent medical biostatistician does the analysis. And I'll share that and I'll publish it up on the website and I'll do a program on it. But this was a generalized health support group. It was not focusing on a single issue. It was just men who wanted to come together to share issues that they found important that they were not getting any input from or help in their regular life through friends or family. I thought that we would have, you know, maybe 30, 50 guys. Well, turned out we had close to 1,000. In fact, there were so many that we had to break it up in sessions every night. And a lot of guys just say that they don't know where to go or who to speak with when they have these anxieties that they can't resolve. And then when we start looking at life and from a more humanistic and holistic and spiritual perspective, that was the best help. And we had amazing improvements. People didn't want the group to end at the end of 6 months. They formed little friendships, and I said, well, then create little pods of 5 people per group and then stay in touch with each other, you know, socialize, talk with each other. So if anyone runs into a crisis, they know they have some people they can rely upon who can give them feedback and help them, who have their back when they've got a problem. We have an awful lot of lonely people. We have a lot of people who feel disconnected and therefore are anxious or depressed. But here's what we didn't know until this study, published in the European College of Neuropsychopharmacology at their Congress. They studied 15,938 men for 15 years. So this is a big study and it's a long study. Quote, men who are plagued with generalized anxiety are more than 200% likely to die of cancer than men who do not have the mental affliction. So, men, it's crucial to begin a program now of dealing with anxiety or depression to help prevent that from happening. More on anxiety and depression in upcoming programs. Smoking leaves lasting marks on your DNA. This is in the U.S. National Institutes of Environmental Health. Quote, smoking cigarettes can leave a lasting imprint on the DNA, altering more than 7,000 genes in ways that may contribute to the development of smoking-related illnesses. Reviewing results from blood samples taken from 16,000 people in 16 prior studies, the researchers also found that for those who stopped smoking, most genes, quote, recovered within 5 years of quitting. Quote, although this emphasizes the long-term residual effect of smoking, the good news is the sooner you can stop smoking, the better off you are. Okay, I agree with that. But I would add something onto that very quickly, and that is the best way to repair DNA, to get the DNA back to where it is no longer going to be susceptible and can start to rejuvenate and build up the immune system, is to start juicing the green dark vegetable juices, those that are spiked with arugula, kale, mustard greens, collard greens. Those are the small amounts, let's say 5% of the juice. The rest of it's a diluting juice, like a cucumber, celery, green apple. But using lots of garlic. Garlic is a sulfur, and that sulfur, along with onions and shallots, is terrific. Ginger is terrific. And you put all that into your juice, and you have 4 or 5 of those juices a day. You're going to chelate out heavy metals, lead, cadmium, and cadmium from the cigarette smoke, but also aluminum, mercury can be taken out of the body that way, and the lungs, and is purifying the lungs. Then take your cumin on a daily basis anywhere from 2 to 5,000 milligrams spread out through the day, and quercetin, 2 to 5,000 milligrams throughout the day, and vitamin C, 5 to 10,000 milligrams a day, and that really helps your lungs. Then vitamin E at 400 units twice a day with 200 units of mixed tocopherols and tocotrienols. That reoxygenates the tissue. And then methylated B12, 1 milligram, methylated folic acid, 1 milligram, and that helps the cells also in the rejuvenation. Ashwagandha also helps. So those are just some ways to prevent the damage from ending up causing you cancer later in life. And it can cause you cancer. Time and again, we see people who stop smoking and feel okay. And 10, 20 years later, they end up with lung cancer. And they say, but I didn't stop. You know, I was smoking. But when you did, there was damage done. You didn't repair the damage. It's only when you repair the damage that's not a problem for you. And finally, from Duke University, they did an interesting study on oxytocin. Oxytocin, T-O-C-I-N. And it's been dubbed the love hormone for its role promoting social bonding, altruism, and more. How many times have you seen a dog that was abandoned and abused, and it's all matted, and it's fearful, and it's living under a car in an alley, and it's malnourished, and it's got fleas, and it's generally has ulcers on its skin. And one of these nice groups go out, and they recover the dog, not to euthanize it, as some of these groups do. In fact, one of the largest groups in the United States, the public doesn't know that they euthanize over 1 million dogs. In any case, those that are actually trying to find homes for them, and then you start to see day one when they, you know, start hand feeding the dog, and then they clean it and give it a bath and shave off all the hair, and then the vet comes in and looks at the teeth and the gums and tries to, you know, help it with all of its, you know, problems. And then gradually it becomes more friendly, and then finally it's loving you, and then you introduce it to other dogs, and they adopt it, and the other dogs and them are just running around and playing, and you just feel altruistic. You just think, wow, you know, I'd love to do that, to adopt one of those dogs, to be able to give love and receive love from something that is so special. That's your oxytocin working. When we see, because an empathy for those that are suffering is also able to have a lasting impact, in part because of oxytocin, where we see something that someone's suffering and we want to help. We're a very giving nation. We're very loving, giving people, especially when we're motivated by these deeper emotions. So that we know. What we didn't know until this study is that oxytocin also supports spirituality. Now, in this study, men reported a greater sense of spirituality shortly after taking oxytocin and a week later. And by the way, a lot of people think of oxycontin, and that's different. That's an opiate that's very dangerous. You never want to use that. Quote, spirituality and meditation have each been linked to health and well-being in previous research. We were interested in understanding biological factors that may enhance those spiritual experiences. Oxytocin appears to be part of the way our body supports spiritual beliefs. And I'm sure that if you've never been to the cloisters, it's just one of the most beneficial places to be. It's just, well, maybe a mile north of the George Washington Bridge and on the old Henry Hudson Parkway. It was brought over here, this monastery. I believe it was the Rockefeller family brought it over. You know, it has the gardens. It's just like if you were in the Italian, mountains, if you were in the French countryside and you went to a monastery, this is what you would expect to see. And then if you listen to Gregorian chants at the same time you're in that environment, wow, what a spiritual experience. You can't help but just feel good about life and with a deeper sense of life. In fact, yesterday you heard on the program Professor Harvey Cox, one of the most respected preeminent theologians in the world, and discussing spirituality from a different perspective, focusing upon the lack of spirituality in the marketplace, but the marketplace taking on the role of the God for a lot of people who have nothing to believe in except the power of a purchase, you know, consumers. And then you have the low-end consumers who cannot afford much, and then you have the very high-end consumers. And one of these consumers I once counseled, and he has a ship that at that time was the largest private-owned yacht in the world. It literally was the size of one of these cruise ships that, you know, 1,000 people go out on. And the issue was not that he liked it. In fact, he didn't. He didn't like sailing. He got seasick. But it was the fact that he would have something no one else would have until someone else built something bigger. And if you also remember the interview I did with the original Wolf of Wall Street, I had the last interview, filmed interview of him before his contract with the film studio and Martin Scorsese, so he couldn't do any more interviews. And in there, in this interview, which is up on the website, you can look at it. It's really worth watching. He talks about how no matter what you have when you're down on Wall Street, it's never enough. And that you have a big yacht and you think, well, isn't this great? And so you want to spend the whole time having your publicist, you know, drop the word that you have this huge lot. And then you find out 2 weeks later that someone has an equally large yacht, but they have a helipad on it, so they have a helicopter. And now you get depressed. Now, for you and I, that seems absurd. But for people who do not have mindful meditation, who are not secreting oxytocin because they have no close relationships, even their pets are not close. In my building where I live in New York, every morning when I come back from my morning workout in Central Park, I see the people running their dogs out to the curb and running them right back in again. That's not what you should do with a dog. You should take them for an hour or two in the park. You know, and all day long, they're just going to be thinking about you and waiting for you. Then I see the dog walkers coming in the afternoon, take them for a walk, and then in the evening, and then they'll run them out the curb at night because they're lonely and they think it's, you know, cool to have the dog. And it's only when the dog gets sick or they got to go put it down because they haven't paid attention to its nutrition and they haven't paid attention to what the dog needs. And finally, the dog was there the whole time for you, but you weren't there for it. But a spiritual person understands, don't take on a responsibility that you cannot maintain. Don't have friendships that you cannot enjoy. Friendships are not about how many names and phone numbers and email addresses you have in an address book or how many people you have on Facebook. Those are completely superfluous. A friend is someone that you actually see, do things with, engage with, and allow them to be who they are. With a friend, you got to take them for what they are. If there's more pluses than minuses, good. If there's more minuses than plus, pass on it. There is no such thing as a perfect person. So don't expect perfection. And people who do, it's because they're fearful of anyone understanding their own imperfections. But when you can be mindful, when you can share positive emotions, when you can be empathetic, when you can be happy to see other people happy, that's your oxytocin. And that allows you to manifest a greater spiritual awareness. The article was published in Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience. So finally, the hard sciences are beginning to appreciate the natural life sciences. Remember, reality always supersedes scientific discovery in our lives as human beings. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Rescue me. I take me in your arms. Rescue me. I want your tender charm.
Now, something nice to have you from all over the world. By the way, tomorrow we are launching in the late afternoon a brand new Progressive Radio Network website. We have we brought in the best designers. I'm not technologically sophisticated enough with computers to understand all that they've been telling me, but we should have very few problems in the future, and we have all these geeks in the office who are looking for the people who've been taking us down because they're not going to be able to do that as easily in the future. So all that's back up. Our internet's back up. All the problems we had in the last 5 days are over, behind us, and we have a whole lot new coming. Now, what can you expect? In the next 5 days, I'll be reporting on the most comprehensive article I've ever seen that I even know exists on how the special interest groups use public relations in the mainstream media to take advantage of us not knowing the truth. So they exploit us like the tobacco industry did by keeping tobacco considered safe for over 100 years when it wasn't, and they knew it. So we're going to show you what's really going on. We're going to pull back the curtain of all the major corporations, of all the PR firms, of all the media connections, and show you how the entire system has been manipulated to sell you products frequently that are dangerous, that you don't need, but how they do it, who they are. We're naming names. You'll find it of interest. Also, I'm listening to the people who are simply misinformed in the mainstream media when it comes to get your flu shots. You need a flu shot. You don't. Why? I'll show you the actual hard science, journals of toxicology, and immunology. The flu shot is not worthless, but dangerous. And I will be doing that presentation in the next 5 days and publishing the article as well. So we have some interesting things. And to our friends up in Woodstock, almost finished with the film. We've got 3 weeks to go, and then it'll be done. This is a major film, by the way. It was filmed all over the world. You'll see footage. And it's a very upbeat film. You're gonna come out of this film smiling instead of angry. The next film after that, you're going to come out angry. But this one, you're going to come out smiling. And it's going to save lives. I'm very, very happy with all the work and effort that's gone into this. So very shortly, I'll be announcing its premiere in different locations, including our friends out in Huntington, at the Huntington Arts Cinema, and up in Woodstock, because I like to go up there. I like the people, I like the energy. So it's probably a month away. We are, in my personal opinion, we are over-identifying ourselves as liberals or conservatives, as Republicans or Democrats. And we're seeing now, if we are honest and objective and we simply pull back, we're seeing that both major parties and their proponents and supporters who are hardwired into their candidates are not looking at what they actually end up doing. They end up selling out the poor and the working class and the middle class for financial interest. And how many times have we heard people say, well, Hillary Clinton, you know, she's a progressive. No, she's not. She does not represent anything progressive on any level. And she's not even liberal. In fact, she and Donald Trump, in my opinion, are classical neoliberalists, meaning they want austerity for you, but abundance for them. They want to make money off tax breaks and subsidies. If they gamble and win, they want to be rewarded exclusively to themselves. If they fail, make a mistake, you, the taxpayer, to bail them out. And yet they'll put their pundits forward to rail against socialism. Now think of that for a moment. Our public schools, our fire department, our police department, our Coast Guard, our National Park Service, all these things, our libraries, all these things that we have and have benefited from, these are all for the common good. That's part of where our taxes go. They're against that. That's what they want to see cut. But they never want to see subsidies, which is socialism, for the tobacco industry that went on for over 100 years. They don't want to see that cut. They don't want to see all the kind of subsidies for big oil and coal and nuclear. They don't want to see those cut. They don't want to see the banking industry have to be responsible when they fail in their derivatives or their deals. They want to be bailed out. In fact, they were, $21 trillion. So this is who we're dealing with. Now, according to Chris Hedges, the Democrats are part of this professional elite. Now, I call them the professional elite industrial complex. These are the people that if you watch Edward Snowden's new film, and I highly recommend that you do so, first you see something that no one's talking about. This guy is borderline, if not genius, in what he does. He was the top of his class. There's one scene in the film, which is based upon a true story, where all these geeks were brought in to through the State Department, but they were actually in the CIA. And they were at a special training ground in a place called The Hill, which is down in Virginia. And there they're told to decode something and reconfigure it, a whole room. And they're given 4 hours to do it. He does it in 46 minutes. So the instructor says, that's not possible. He said, yeah, it is. Not only did he do it, but he did it in a way that they had never thought about doing it and could not have done it. And everything he did in every job, because you don't have someone going into civil service and going to being sent to Geneva and then sent to Japan and sent to Hawaii and sent all over the world to solve problems unless you're the best of the best. And he was. And the reason that Snowden became a whistleblower was not because he wanted to get anyone in trouble. He simply finally saw that virtually everything that was being done by the National Security Agency was illegal. They did not have the law on their side. And that's why he finally, after years of working for them, he finally decided enough is enough. And in Hawaii, he downloaded their secrets and smuggled out. And he smuggled out in a Rubik's Cube. Very clever. Because everything else was screened and double screened. And he just handed it to the guy and got through and then went to the Orient, and that's where Southeast Asia, and that's where he was. That's where the story picks up as far as Glenn Greenwald and everyone else goes. Now, there's a whole preceding story. But it was seeing these corrupt people. But you have to know, who are the corrupt people? Well, how about all these munition factories? And one new missile might have 50 different corporations making parts for it. And now they just announced $1 trillion going to be spent for a nuclear weapon. And there are 1,000 different corporations that are going to supply material for that. And they're all going to be on a cost-plus basis, which means that whatever the cost is going to be, it's going to be 2 or 3 times more than that. And there you're talking about probably 10,000 technocrats, the so-called professional elite, who come from the Ivy League schools, many of whom know each other, either by reputation or by having worked in agencies of the government, and they go from the government to a consulting firm, to a lobbying firm, and back into the government, but they're all serving each other's interest and their own. And they represent over 200,000 businesses that represent probably 4 or 5 million people. So you're not talking about a few people. You're talking about many people who have a stake in Hillary Clinton or Barack or George Bush or Donald Trump becoming president. It's not just typical wishlist. There's a lot of money that comes with it. So what this does, it gives us a sense that we are morally bankrupt, but we're only one piece of the fake democracy that characterizes our system of inverted totalitarianism. The problem is not only liberals who are not liberal, it's also conservatives, once identified with small government, rule of law, fiscal responsibility, community service, who are not conservative. Think of all the conservatives, Mark Levine and the other hardcore people like Sean Hannity, but they all want bigger government because they want to put more money in the military industrial complex. They don't want any of the subsidies taken away from any of the major corporations. They want a major fuel. They're in global warming denialism. Well, that means that trillions of dollars is going to go to the groups they want. That's only creating a larger government, and they want to then cut food stamps and cut programs for the poor. That's not what a real conservative does, but that's their form of conservatism. So it's fake. They're all fake. And so we have liberals who are not liberal. We have people calling themselves progressive who are not progressive. And it is a court system that we have that has abandoned justice and rather than defend constitutional rights, has steadily stripped them from us through judicial fiat. It is a Congress that does not legislate, but instead permits lobbyists and corporations to write legislation at the state level through ALEKS, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Over 25,000 laws they've written and given and were passed by your state legislators. Well, then how's that legislator in your state representing you? And then at the federal level, it's just a lot more money and promises that after that senator or house member or president or vice president leaves office, there's a big job waiting for him. It is our press that is deplorable, desperate for the advertising dollars and often owned by large corporations, that does not practice journalism. It is academics and commentators and public intellectuals, often paid by corporate think tanks, who function in shameless cheerleaders for the neoliberal and imperial establishment and mock the concept of independent and critical thought. The Democrat and professional elites are an easy and often amusing target. One could see them in another era prancing at a masked ball at Versailles on the eve of the revolution. There is obviously something terribly wrong, something terribly amiss in our society today. You know, during Barack Obama's administration, there was near total continuity with the administration of George W. Bush, especially regarding mass surveillance, endless war, and the failure to regulate Wall Street. And this is because the mechanisms of corporate power embodied in the deep state do not change with election cycles. The election of Donald Trump, however, distasteful, would not radically alter corporate control over our lives. The corporate state is impervious to political personalities. If Trump continues to rise in the public opinion polls, the corporate backers of Hillary Clinton will start funding him instead. They know that no matter which one wins, they are immediately going to prostitute themselves to money as assiduously as any of the previous presidents have. So our political elites, Republican or Democrat, were shaped, funded, and largely selected by corporate power brokers. And this is what we have today. Nothing will change until corporate power is dismantled. To dismantle corporate power, you have to remove their charters and hold their executives accountable as criminals when they commit a crime and not allow them to walk away with paying a fine, which is just the cost of doing business. I'm Gary Knoll. Talk back in a few moments. You can call in at 888-874-4888. Now, I'm going to do two things on Haiti. The first is I'm going to read you from Dabby Cherry, C-H-E-R-Y, an article called I, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Haiti's Pay to Play, and then we're going to play a little audio clip as well. From its inception, and well before it made $10 billion of earthquake aid money disappear, Bill and Hillary Clinton's Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, the IHRC, was a vicious joke on Haitians. The original name, the Commission of Reconstruction in Haiti, should have been simply translated as Interim Commission for the Reconstruction of Haiti. After all, it was the commission that was temporary, not Haiti. There was also no need to change the word reconstruction to the vague term recovery unless one deliberately wanted to suggest the collection of something. As the commission, however, the organization not only acquired Hillary Rodham Clinton's initials, but also boasted that it would scoop up Haiti's reconstruction funds and turn the world's first black republic into a temporary construct. The great writer Toni Morrison once described Bill Clinton as, quote, our first black president. Because of his background as a poor boy in Arkansas from a single-parent home, his fondness for junk food, and the political attacks on his sexuality. If so, then he has graduated to being the first black African-American dictator of Haiti for 6 years of a full dictatorship of the Clintons and their surrogates. On earthquake anniversaries, Haitians at home and in the diaspora have made a ritual of searching through the rubble for the reconstruction funds that were donated by good people all around the world. Where did the money go? Everyone asks. The answer is simple. For a while, probably set in a Swiss or Caribbean offshore banks where dictators stash their loot. It's not possible to raise billions of dollars legitimately for political campaigns. More and more in the West and in emerging market economies, these astronomical sums for elections are extracted from unsuspecting taxpayers. We have Brazil to thank for some insights into the machinations of politicians to finance their campaigns. In Brazil, the state energy company, Petrobras, was granted contracts to construction companies with the understanding that a percentage of the funds would be applied to the campaigns of various corrupt politicians. The money laundering scandal, which involved more than $15 billion and led to the president, Dilma Rousseff's impeachment, is estimated to have touched every political party and 70% of the country's ministers and legislators. In effect, the entire country is corrupt. For the Clintons, the boom from Haiti's earthquake of January 12, 2010 came while Hillary Rodham Clinton was Secretary of State and Bill Clinton was the United Nations Special Envoy to Haiti. As soon as massive numbers of Americans began to donate small sums of money for earthquake relief, Bill and Hillary transformed themselves into the face of Haiti. In their most calculated, compassionate voices, they told stories about their marvelous honeymoon on the island and implored the public for donations. In reality, in the U.S. State Department, the move was festive. On February 1st, the U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, Kenneth Merton, cheerfully titled a section of his situation report, quote, "The Gold Rush is On." And by March 8, 2010, Bill Clinton had applied sufficient pressure on President René Préville to force Haiti's lower house to vote yes on a state of emergency that would allow a group that he personally selected of outside donors to run Haiti for 18 months via this private consortium. During the same month, Hillary Clinton went to Montreal to raise money, ostensibly for Haiti's reconstruction, and Bill Clinton went to Davos to collect from the rich donors. The next month, Bill Clinton worked to push his project on Haiti's Senate, where it was ironically called a coup d'etat. The Senate voted no on April 8th, but President Préville insisted on another vote. In the next vote on April 13th, 10 out of 25 senators stayed home to prevent a quorum. On April 14th, Michelle Obama made a special trip to Haiti, and the next day the deal was done. The vote was 9 away, 2 abstaining, 1 no, and 13 yes. All but one of the yes votes came from the president's party. Thus, slightly more than 3 months after the earthquake, they inaugurated this giant scheme. And with this group, the Clintons established in Haiti their dream government. This was the pay-to-play of unelected governments. People were political participants, and it was based on money invested. With their group, meaning the Clinton group, there were two parts, one foreign and the other Haitian. Bill Clinton chaired the foreign section, which included the representatives of 14 donors, including Brazil and Canada, France, Venezuela, Inter-American Development Bank, United Nations, World Bank, Organization of American States, and the private donors in the diaspora and the NGOs. Each donor had to pledge to this group $100 million over 2 years or forgive $200 million of Haitian debt. The poor Haitian section of this group had only 7 members, and Haiti's prime minister, Jean-Max Bellerive, formally led it as the nominal co-chair. The other 6 members were President Préville, who was allowed only a symbolic veto, plus one person each to represent the lower house, judiciary, business, and unions. Every Haitian member had to be approved by foreigners. In fact, former President Bill Clinton ran the entire show. Now, as the reconstruction money poured in, their group, the Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton group, became increasingly arrogant and opaque. According to their charter, Clinton and the current president gained the right of final approval over all major construction projects in Haiti. In addition, they even gave themselves the power to grant titles. Meanwhile, Haitian elected officials were blocked from the meetings because they were, quote, not on a list. So if you were a regular Haitian, you couldn't get in. If you were a member of their parliament, if you were a member of their house, you couldn't know what was going on. You were closed out. If you were in the media, you couldn't find out any facts. So it was a closed organization, completely opaque, and they did what they wanted to do. Now, they collected $5.3 billion over 2 years, $9.9 billion over 3 years. But they didn't construct anything. There you have it. $9.9 or $10 billion goes in, with the Clintons controlling all of it, but nothing gets built. Now, this represents more than five times the money that the Clintons had collected by other mechanisms like the Clinton Foundation or their Laureate Education. Bill Clinton has claimed at various times, well, we don't know how much we received. So finally, they got so fed up with all this that they decided to ask for an audit. Now, this is the interesting part of this article. It's virtually over. The co-chair for the people, wanted to make sure that money was actually being spent, but they couldn't find any money being spent except on the Caracal Industrial Park. Just as an aside, that was not touched by the earthquake at all. That was in the north of Haiti, but that's where Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and their friends, the pay-to-play people, that's where they all started looking at how they could use this money. And they brought in their friends, including South Korean garment industry people, and they hired at very cheap labor the Haitians in that area who were not even the victims of the earthquake. They were literally slave wage jobs in an industrial park built without regard to its environmental impact, and it destroyed the homes of hundreds of farmers and polluted a pristine river and a bay. Now, how much did they put into that? They put in $230 million. That's a lot of money. And at the end of their 18-month term, the Haitian politicians publicly declared it to be dysfunctional, meaning the Clinton group and the Haitian Senate did not renew its mandate. And on April 10, 2014, two Haitian lawyers, Newton Lewis and Andre Michael, filed a legal action against Bill Clinton in Haiti's Supreme Court of Auditors and Administrative Dispute. On April 13th, the court asked Clinton to provide an audit of where they spent all the money. Now, here's what no one has heard. Rather than abide by the court's request, Bill Clinton claimed immunity based upon the fact that he had been the UN Special Envoy to Haiti. So, go to Haiti today, and you'll see a country that looks like it had just finished the earthquake yesterday, with the exception of in the mountains, the nicest areas. And there, the NGOs, the non-government organizations, have spent a lot of money building beautiful villas for the staff. The Haitians, no. So who knew this? But no one has held either Clinton accountable for where did the $10 billion go. Now, let's play a clip of how the Clinton Foundation ripped off Haiti, and this is from Vice TV.
Last year, Vice visited Haiti to report on the massive deforestation of the country to fuel the black market charcoal business. Our reporters, while they were there, were shocked at how devastated Haiti still looked 5 years after the earthquake. Almost $10 billion in relief aid had been pledged from around the world, yet many parts of Port-au-Prince still look like the earthquake struck just yesterday. So we sent Vikram Gandhi back to Haiti to see how one of the world's largest ever relief efforts could fall so far short.
When a 7.0 earthquake struck Haiti in January 2010, an estimated 316,000 people were killed, and another 2 million were forced from their homes. When disasters like this strike, the natural human impulse is to want to help. But even after billions of dollars in foreign aid, 5 years later, hundreds of thousands of survivors are still displaced. At Delma 33, their camp coordinator gave us a look at their living conditions.
This is a tent city that's been in effect for the last 4.5 years. We're gonna check out what it's like to be a refugee of the earthquake.
So what are these homes made of? Then with a functioning toilet.
This is the reality of Haitian sanitation. So inevitably, human waste gets into the water supply.
This is not just disgusting, it's potentially deadly. In fact, a year after the earthquake, Haiti suffered the world's largest modern outbreak of cholera. It was actually brought there by UN foreign relief workers whose waste contaminated local water supplies. With 700,000 people infected and nearly 9,000 deaths, we learned from Dr. Jean Papé that new cases of this easily preventable infection are still popping up.
What's the relationship of cholera spreading and the lack of sanitation?
Oh, it's huge. Essentially, in a place where you don't have adequate latrines, where people don't have water to wash their hands, it's going to spread like wildfire, like it did here.
With the long-term relief aid in Port-au-Prince appearing to be completely squandered, we spoke to Jake Johnston, whose five-year investigation into Haiti relief funds has made him the premier economic researcher on following the money trail.
After the earthquake, millions of Americans started donating to help Haiti. Where did all that money go?
You know, in terms of private donations, most of it goes through emergency response, clearing rubble, clean water, some basic health, food aid. The long-term or development aid, that comes mostly from the donor governments. The U.S. government, the leaders of the development banks, all had the slogan, build back better. This was supposed to be different. This was the opportunity with $10 billion on the table. The big question that's been on everyone's mind is, where did the money go? And I think that's when we enter this sort of black box. Congress appropriates money to USAID, and then USAID contracts other organizations, both for-profit and non-for-profit, that actually implement the programs on the ground. For every dollar that USAID spends, less than a penny actually goes directly to any Haitian organization, Haitian company, Haitian government. Rather than giving money to local companies, things were imported. So we imported cement, we imported the foreign experts, we imported the construction companies to actually build them. Right after the earthquake, they had an ambitious housing program. So they had planned to build about 15,000 houses. It cost about $53 million. The cost ballooned to $93 million. And instead of 15,000 houses, there would be 2,600 houses. You know, at the same time, the U.S. Embassy gave a contract for over $70 million to build townhouses with pools for their own staff. That's that fundamental divide between what we think of as aid and helping those in need and how our system actually works.
And while we built plenty of homes for our own people, we didn't seem to build many for the survivors who needed them. That's because of plans like the Zarangé Housing Expo, which was one of the first approved reconstruction projects headed by Bill Clinton and the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission. The basic idea of Zarangé is a $2.4 million showroom. International firms competed to sell their prototypes with the hopes of winning a contract for mass production.
So behind me are model homes. None of them have any plumbing, electricity, or running water. But what happened after the expo is people moved in, they occupied this property, and now it's become a fully functioning town.
Camille Chalmers, an affordable housing activist, gave us some insight on how viable the houses actually were.
This seems like a log cabin you might find like by Yellowstone National Park. Did you think there was ever a chance that these were going to be built in Haiti?
No. D'abord, bois très cher, ça je sais. En plus, nous avons une crise au niveau écologique qui fait que nous n'avons pas grand pile de disponibilité en termes de bois.
What do you make of this one?
Non, ça c'est vraiment horrible.
This is one of my personal favorites. That looks like something from like Martha's Vineyard.
C'est intéressant, mais que par contre, c'est son caille qui est très résistant pour cyclone.
Are you telling me that they didn't talk to people from Haiti before they came here to try to sell these houses?
Non. Non, c'était rapidement proposé un modèle et fait un cob.
That house, that's some hippie shit right there.
Non, ça c'est spectaculaire, vraiment.
How many homes were actually built for Haitians based on any of these model homes?
Zéro, pas rien du tout, pas rien.
So not only were no real homes built, but the survivors are left in the same primitive conditions as the refugee camps, squatting in a permanent reminder of what our aid intended to give them. But this squat is nothing compared to what we saw in the mountains of Canaan. With limited options in the city, survivors began building their own homes in this formerly barren land. Now, what began as a refugee camp is so big that if recognized, it would qualify as one of Haiti's largest cities.
So this place has all been built up in the last 4 years. This was supposed to be temporary, but very soon, it became permanent.
And as we learned from community organizer Renelle Sanon, these people were left to fend for themselves.
Boy, si t'as pas gagné aucune aide, Canaran, c'est côté Mounio, avec si GFO yo yo fait ni ONG ni gouvernement pour aider moun yo construire.
What's odd is that the Haitians who receive little to no foreign aid actually seem to be doing better than those in the designated relief areas.
Did you build this house?
Oui, moi madame moi ka vin graje. Non dégage nous.
Did you get any help from the government or any NGOs?
Moi pou kont moi ladan eux parce m'bagain gouvernement ensemble avec du tout.
If you see what he is doing, you'll see they're all in this precariously built tin, little tiny. A house is just four sides of tin with some wood holding it up. That's it. It wouldn't even qualify for a shack in the United States. And there are 200,000 to 300,000 people there. There's no water. There's no septic system. But they all look down upon a multi-million-dollar soccer stadium that was built in the middle of nowhere because of Clinton. Someone made the money from it, and it's always the same group, and this is a group that donates to the Clinton Foundation. So anyhow, the rest of the discussion was about 15 minutes, and we posted it on our website. So we're out of time now. Thank you all for listening. To all of our Haitian friends and activists, I will continue to report on what we see as the issues involving Haiti and provide you with a forum to share your insights as well. Have a nice day, everyone.